Hi there, just a quick note before we get into our first episode for Season 2. If this is your first time listening to True North, you can find all of Season 1 and our Master Series interviews at truenorthpodcast.com. In Series 1, we covered everything from the UX of implants to designing for decreased anxiety in sick children, through to designing for education and the importance of diversity in our industry. In the Master Series, we spoke to and learned from folks who have been UX leads at Google, Salesforce, SAP, Adobe, and MailChimp. So find us on Apple Podcasts or go to truenorthpodcast.com. Now, I'm excited to bring you the first episode of Season 2, Designing for Scale, inside Atlassian's design teams.
When I joined Atlassian, I thought that every single Atlassian team worked in the same way. We're an agile shop and everybody followed agile religiously to the same framework. When I joined, I was thrown straight into a cross-product project and I found very quickly that every team followed agile and agile methodology, but every team did it slightly differently. Or they were following Kanban and one was following Scrum. And so that just blew my mind when I joined, to be honest, because I came in thinking it'll just be down pat, it'll be all in sync, everything will be happening to a specific way. And yet it wasn't, every team wasn't doing everything exactly the same. Teams get autonomy to own the outcome. If they feel that they need to follow a very rigid Scrum process to get to the right outcome, they're empowered to do that. If they feel that they can work more effectively to get to the outcome in a Kanban style, that's totally fine as well. And it also is shaped by the individuals that they have on the team. Do they have the right people to run Scrum effectively? Again, the team lead does own that, but good team leads will be engaging with their team and working out what the best way for that team to work is. But many teams may switch depending on the project that they're running.
That's Alistair Simpson. He's a senior designer for software teams at Atlassian. So Alistair is talking about teams and people and relationships. I don't know about you, but when I think of companies like Atlassian or Google or Uber and Airbnb, I don't think of them as companies of people. I think of them more like an entity which I guess sometimes acts as a proxy for their founders. But when we look under the hood, past the marketing veneer, it's not surprising that we find hundreds or thousands of passionate people working collaboratively and under often challenging circumstances to deliver an experience which solves problems for you and me. So that's what we're going to look at today. How does Atlassian coordinate hundreds of people across many products, time zones, and countries to design and deliver an experience to thousands of customers around the world? Hi, and welcome to True North. My name is Ben Newton, and I'm from Loop 11. This is the podcast where we share stories of discovery and innovation. We're going to dive into how Atlassian's teams work together, but before we do, let's get a better understanding of how they think about design.
If I take it a little bit of a step back, so like many designers will create these awesome mock-ups and you create the static PNGs or static Photoshop or sketch files or whatever tool that you're using, or maybe you prototype something up, but it's not actually until it's in the hands of customers and actually translated into an experience that a customer sees and feels that it's actually real. And that's what we push our design teams on, is making sure that we're not just creating these beautiful visions or decks that look really nice about how a customer might experience something, but it's actually making sure that the end experience that the customer feels and touches and sees is a really great experience for them. And that means that they need to work really closely with engineering, really closely with QA, really closely with product management to make sure that we're getting all of the things in the right place to create a great experience. Because a great experience is not a PNG that's sitting in some folder somewhere or on some Confluence instance that says, hey, this is what the design could look like. It's actually what gets out to the customer.
What more and more of us are coming to realize is that design doesn't happen in a vacuum. It's informed by many factors. One of those is user research. Here's Georgie Bottomley. She's a senior UX researcher for software teams at Atlassian.
So when I first joined the company, there wasn't any sort of process. There certainly wasn't any repeatable process that you could follow in order to be able to run a usability test or even just have a day of customer interviews to understand kind of what was going on with your product. So what we really wanted to do was to change that, to empower our designers, to allow them to adopt the kind of the lean, little and often research, which we all know is hugely impactful on a product. So for Ship It 33, we decided to change that.
I'm going to jump in here just to explain what Ship It is. Ship It is a quarterly one-day hackathon ran from within Atlassian, where employees can self-organize into teams to solve any problem that they can see within the company. Back to Georgie.
So Ship It can literally be anything. So for Ship It 33, we decided to create a usability testing lab. And the crazy thing is with usability testing is you don't actually need anything fancy to be able to run a user test. My mum gets so angry when I say this because she's like, Georgie, you're putting yourself out of a job. Like if people know how easy it is, you'll never get work again. But it really is so, so simple. Like everything that you need to run a usability test is all on a laptop. All you need is a laptop and a room and you can use a test anything.
So Georgie and her team commandeered an unused meeting room and created a dedicated space from which to run usability tests.
And what that meant is we could then create a repeatable process that empowered our teams to do research.
And thus, AtLab was born. And since its creation, it has taken the company by storm. So much so that it's become, well, a verb.
So people will say, hey, have you AtLabbed that? Okay, yeah, this looks great, but what did AtLab say? It really is something that we kind of we hold ourselves to. So AtLab now runs every other week for every product across the globe. We get somewhere between 6 to 8 customers in and they test everything and anything for us. So we can constantly be getting that kind of iterative feedback on where we're going as a team and what our designs are.
Complementing design and user research is the often overlooked information architecture wordy craftsmanshipery. Here's Claire Marnie. She can probably do a better job of describing this.
It actually is hard to describe because it's called something different everywhere. So information experience is a new term to me as well when I arrived at Atlassian. Previously, I've worked in technical communications teams, support teams and other kinds of teams that do the same function. To me, yeah, the naming's kind of important because naming things is part of what I do.
Thinking of it from a design perspective, Claire's role is to ensure information of any sort is relatable and useful for users targeting not their expertise, but rather their current location in the Atlassian product flow. One particular area of focus for Claire is something she likes to call the defluffing of content.
I'm always mentally defluffing. I defluff birthday cards and, you know, emails and any kind of piece of information I get anyway. It's part of my discipline or whatever my makeup to kind of really boil things down to its simplest form. When I look at our product, I see a lot of accumulated information. I see as having had a simple feature that we've built on and built on and built on, and we haven't kind of cleaned out some of the old information about it. And in some cases, we haven't even kind of cleaned out some of the old, what might be called design debt or information debt. I am really aware that not everyone likes that stripped back version of things. But again, that's sort of like, that's about me saying, but that gets the user to the information they need much faster than the path where you tell them a bit of a story and it helps them, which is useful for beginners maybe, but not as useful for people just trying to solve a problem. It's about stripping out things where you should strip out things. Just because you're a technical person doesn't mean you need to be communicated to in a technical way. You don't get anyone technical complaining that things are too simple usually. You get people who don't understand technical things complaining they can't understand them. So to me, it's definitely that's who you write for.
Just as information experience traverses the user's journey, so does product design. But Atlassian doesn't stop there. Rather, they have whole teams of designers focusing solely on designing for growth. Here's Benjamin Berger, a growth designer at Atlassian.
Being in growth is a bit different of what a proper product designer would do per se, but to give you an idea of the variety of tasks we can work on, the first one would be to work with our user researcher to identify opportunity or places in our product where we might lack knowledge or we might not be sure that everything is being very optimized. And then the designer would work with the rest of the team to draw the big picture of the story, where we define, so we use various artifacts. We use a design wall, for example, where we literally write down every single step of a user experience on a huge wall to make sure that it resonates to everybody. And then we plug every piece of data to the wall. So we have a holistic view of what's happening in the experience. And out of this, the designer would be in charge of what we call the ideation and would have as the role of the facilitator to do some workshop session or brainstorming session and take everybody through the research and then brainstorm and ideate on possible solution to solve the problem that we've identified.
So we're now starting to form a picture of the cross-functional nature that exists within and around design teams. One of the fascinating practices that these teams utilize to get past bottlenecks is something called design sparring.
Generally, we will look internally within the organization for someone else to question or someone else to spar or bounce ideas off around that problem that they're having. In design, we call them design sparring. So it's kind of feedback, and that goes all the way up from design team leads to myself to our head of design, who will come to my team sparring. And quite often, if we're at a stage with a team where they don't feel like they are making headway, we'll try and get them into some kind of sparring session and get a different perspective on it and try and make the team think a bit differently about the problem set that they have.
Put simply, the job of a sparring partner is to ask the hard questions and to challenge the potentially limiting assumptions.
One of the good things that I think we do here, and some people when they join can find it quite confronting, is not the right word, but just different to where they've come from before, is that we're quite candid internally with our feedback. There's a good framework called Radical Candor by Sheryl Sandberg. It talks about being really candid and radically candid with your feedback, because it shows that you care and it shows that you actually want the team to progress, because you're not just saying, oh yeah, it seems like you've done everything you can do. And so the job of that person to come in is to really ask the team thought-provoking questions that may help them think differently about how they're approaching that problem.
To look at how design sparring is planned for and incorporated into Atlassian's processes, we'll go back to the growth team. Here's Julian Femia, a team lead for Jira Software.
When we have an experiment, we always try to find the success metric, and then there's the design process. When we have something that we're confident is showable to the customers, we first put that design through what we call design sparring internally. So it's the designers, not only from the team, but also outside the team, that come and can give feedback. And once we've done that, we do the same thing with user research, so with customers. So we show them the design, we ask them for feedback. Based on that feedback, we might tweak a little bit, and then we put it in front of the customer inside an experiment. And at the same time, if we have the capacity and the time, we try to do another user research on the final design, so that we can have both quantitative and qualitative feedback. It's important to have both, at least for us internally. So we always try to combine them into everything that we do, even in the analysis.
One of the great challenges in a rapidly growing company is the sharing of knowledge and communication surrounding what different and related parts of the company are working on. In the face of managing teams across three products and three different time zones, Alistair has thought a lot about how to best tackle these issues.
There's a personal challenge and a team challenge. Personal challenges, I talk a lot. I go for coffees with a lot of people. When I'm doing design critique, I like to stand at a wall and look at it physically and see the reactions of my team. And I'd say I'm probably a people person. And so being across multiple regions restricts that. The team challenge is, how do you make sure that your teams in different locations are totally understanding of what's going on in the different offices? Where is a specific design up to? More and more, our products are becoming much more tightly integrated. So most of the design work for Jira Software happens out of Sydney and Bitbucket in Austin and San Francisco. But maybe the Jira Software designers are working through something and it makes a lot of sense to connect to Bitbucket. How do you connect those teams when they don't sit next to each other, when they don't talk like verbally like every single day, they don't meet for coffee, to have those kind of water cooler moments and those kind of accidental kind of interactions? One of the ways, it's quite a tactical way to overcome that. I don't have team meetings in the traditional sense. I have 20 people. I don't get 20 people on VC at some really early time for Sydney and really late time for Austin and some in the middle time for San Francisco. Instead, I every fortnight will run an async team meeting where I'll just post up there what's going on in every single location. I'll get information from different teams on what's going on in every single location. And then I'll also put in there things that are happening at a management level, so at my level across design. And that then helps filter information down to the teams. And that then builds connections with the teams. And probably another one, we try to replicate the analog walls that we have. So we print them out and put them on walls and critique them. We created these, what we call virtual walls, every single month. So a virtual wall is every single designer will post up their work, and then the team can go in and start commenting. And again, they build up an understanding of, oh, that's what the Austin team are working on right now. Because again, as we've scaled to over 120 designers, it's hard for a designer in Austin working on Bitbucket to know what the Confluence team in Sydney are working on. So that's something that we're looking to scale across the company.
A perfect example of where communication needs to be optimized is between the various growth teams. With a team for each product and then a core team that traverses multiple products, it's important to coordinate planning and to share learning so efforts are not repeated or overlapped.
All the experiments that we run on the different products and on the website are what we call mutually exclusive. So they're all run separately so that a customer is not seeing two experiments at the same time. That allows us to really measure what's the effect of the different experiences and the different experiments that we do. And to avoid conflicts, we have several meetings during the week. There's one meeting which is kind of a weekly experiment scheduling meeting where we talk about what are the different experiments that are ready to go, what is the capacity that we have, and depending also on the success criteria and how important they are and what we think is going to be their impact, we rate them. And so then it's easier for us to just know, okay, so that one is going to go first, that one is going to wait a little bit more. And there's also, we do as a growth team a weekly meeting every Thursday where we talk about everything that we've learned, what are the different experiments that we're working on, what are the main insights from past experiment, the different results, all those kind of things.
Of course, the goal of all of this is to ensure an impact is being made and that the right problems are being solved. Something which acts as a compass to ensure that these goals are being met is the user research. Here's Georgie again.
As a researcher, you're fairly early on, I guess, in that process. So I think the things that you can impact most highly is the way a solution is formed, the priority that solutions have in terms of the backlog, and where you think the product should be going in terms of the roadmap. As we all know, working in the software space or working in any kind of problem solution space, you really need to start off with a really good understanding of your customer, their context, and what pain points or what problems they have in their day-to-day life or in the context in which they potentially interact with your product or your service. If you don't have a very clear understanding of the problem, you're never going to solve the problem. If your understanding of the problem is a symptom, you're equally never going to solve the problem. You're going to do something on the periphery. They might use it temporarily, but as soon as a service or a product comes along that actually solves their root problem, they're going to leave you for a competitor or they're going to leave you for someone else. So it's absolutely imperative as UX designers, as product managers, for us to really understand the problem in the first place that our users are trying to solve. So there's lots of different ways you can do that. Ideally, this is sort of towards the beginning of the process. You're probably going out doing kind of very big, very broad brush strokes in terms of research. So typically that's sort of things like contextual inquiries, interviews, potentially even surveys at this level to kind of validate what you found in the contextual inquiries. And this allows you to get a sense of that context, which is so important. So, you know, are people switching between this and that and the other? What are the other tensions or like pain points that they have in their life? Like, where are they sitting in the world? And really, really start to hone in on what's the real problem? Like, what's the real problem, not the symptom? What's this real problem that's happening? Once you've got a really clear idea of what that is, you start to come up with potential ways for you to solve it. I think what's so important here is for you to validate that as quickly as possible. It's very easy to get carried away and very excited, like, yes, I now know the customer and I'm going to go off and do this, that and the other. And actually you get there and you're like, ah, this never worked. So as quickly as possible, making sure that you're validating your potential solution just saves you a lot of time and a lot of heartache. So when you talk about finding the right solution, it's ensuring that we pull customers in. So in the same way that we go off and speak to customers or potential customers in the very beginning to understand their problem, we then speak to them again to say, hey, this solution, like, what do you think? How could this work for you? How couldn't this work for you? And by doing that work, it ensures that anything that we come to kind of later on in the process, we know is valuable, we know is going to give customer benefit.
A lot of what Georgie is talking about is what is known as qualitative research. To complement that, Atlassian receives an ocean of quantitative feedback, which it needs to thoughtfully wade through. Here's Alistair again.
We get 300,000 pieces of qualitative feedback via NPS, so Net Promoter Score, every single year. And those pieces of feedback can be anything from great to long, long paragraphs about something that somebody's passionate about in our products. And so from a lot of that feedback, we kind of distill that down using something called the RUF framework. The RUF framework stands for reliability, usability, and functionality. And what we do is we take the NPS feedback and we say, well, are they talking about performance or reliability? Are the people talking about usability or design? Or are they asking for a feature or saying this feature doesn't exist? And then what we do is we'll look at those individual buckets and we'll say, well, which is a highest priority? Where are people struggling with the most? Are a lot of people asking for more features, or are people saying that the performance is too slow? Where I started talking about design pairing with engineering, last year we had a big push on performance to make the cloud products much faster, and that had a huge impact on our customers on how they experienced our products once we focused on that.
So there are multiple ways that the teams at Atlassian feel for and evaluate the pulse of their users. A particularly interesting method revolves around a weekly personalized email that designers receive.
The other thing that we do get is every single Monday, we get an email from the voice of the customer team, which pulls out some of these verbatim quotes from different products, and we just get that sent to us via email every Monday. What our teams will then do is the product managers and designers will go through, and they'll get, like the designers will get the usability bucket, for example, and they will go through that and they will start reading them, and then they will categorize that further and say, well, it's usability or design, but they're really talking about X. Or this, talking about this specific thing. Again, it's about reinforcing that customer empathy and thinking about our customers. That's a key thing for us.
Despite being in its 15th year, Atlassian is constantly evolving and looking for new and better ways to design and deliver value to its millions of users.
Atlassian's certainly one of the most unique places I've worked. And one of the reasons for that is that design is really pushed, is very at the front of where our product's being developed, or it is at the moment. I know historically it hasn't been. It's been very engineering-led. But also that the research is factoring in, and it's a very quick, closed, useful loop for us to kind of iterate through design and research and communication and get features out the door that are much more robust. They're still part of the product that is, but that just have that extra rigor and extra kind of consideration and good data behind those considerations. So that's been a really great surprise that could get done so fast, I think.
So we've heard about a lot of great processes and people who are helping to ensure progress is made. But something that I feel is equally, if not more important, is a mindset that Alistair feels is at the core of the design team's success.
I don't know whether it's a belief, but something that I've grown much more comfortable with at Atlassian, because you're encouraged to, is the ability as a design manager and as a design lead to say, I don't know. And I'm much, much more comfortable saying that now than I was as a young manager maybe 10 years ago. Because 10 years ago, I believed that management was about knowing everything and being seen to know exactly what to do in every single situation. At Atlassian, you're very much encouraged to, you know, you may not know the answers, but you should work through that with your team and you should embrace that. And your team will often help you work through that problem and you'll get to a better outcome by saying, I don't know, I'm not sure what to do right now, but let's explore that together. And that's my job, is not to just say I don't know and throw my hands in the air and say I'm not sure what to do, but to show leadership and say, but here's how we're going to try and get to the outcome and explore it with them as a group. Because people want to feel ownership over solutions. And so your job as a manager or leader is not to just tell them what to do, it's to engage them throughout that process.
To find links from this episode, visit truenorthpodcast.com. And while you're there, you can also join the community and find all the episodes from Season 1 and the Master Series. True North is available on Apple Podcasts, where you can subscribe or leave a review. We'd love to hear what you think of the show, so please rate us. Our music is by the mysterious Breakmaster Cylinder. True North is produced by Loop 11. We'll see you next time.